Coben. Dr. Coben is an author, columnist, financial planner, and international lecturer. He holds a Ph.D. degree in public policy, M.A. degrees in economics and business economics, and is a graduate of Reformed Bible College. Dr. Coben is an outspoken critic of public schools, government regulation, the IRS, paper money, welfare, and abortion. An evangelical Christian and the father of six homeschooled children, Dr. Coben is applauded by listeners across America and around the world as a champion of liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Now let's join Dr. Coben with Christian Worldview.
And we welcome you to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. This is the 15th day of November, 2005. Glad you joined us. We're off the air yesterday due to a power outage, and this morning we're back on. Unfortunately, we have some notices of outages here and there, and we're sorry about that, and we'll be working on those as soon as possible to get them corrected. Hopefully, we'll have a lot of folks on the webcast today listening to this educational broadcast as we bring you great information and important information regarding the Christian faith, regarding public policy, and so forth. We have lots of stories to catch up with, having missed a Monday. You know, Mondays are always big days for stories and so forth, so we're going to have a lot of things to go back over. And, boy, there's a lot to do today, and it may end up being actually an abbreviated show, believe it or not, even though we have so much to cover, just because we're still trying to recover from the events of yesterday with various things that went on, especially with the power outage here. But we'll do our best. So at any rate, make sure that you tell other people about the Tyranny Response Network, tyrannyresponse.com, tyrannyresponse.net, and be supportive. Help other people, share the information with other people that they might be able to know more and more about what's going on with the Tyranny Response Network here in the upstate of South Carolina and anywhere in the world they listen on the web. Well, this last weekend we had a wonderful conference in Atlanta. It was called the Atlanta Freedom Conference, sponsored by the Freedom Law School. I was an invited guest along with people like Ted Gunderson, from the former FBI agent who's now telling people the truth about what's going on in the FBI. We also had a opportunity to talk with other folks there, or hear other folks there, such as Bob Schultz, who's the president of the We the People Foundation. There were people like Mr. Paymon and Mr. Robert Clarkson, both there talking about their different ideas and aspects of freedom, which they love to discuss. I had an opportunity to talk about the perverse incentives of economic actors through smog, the example of smog, I should say, as well as the example of allodialism, and how allodialism is the key thing that we can use to regain private property rights, to regain an upper hand on externalities, as they're called, or the so-called provisions of the state in order to solve social problems. So anyway, those are all things that are up in the upper echelons of discussion that went on this weekend, and we were happy to be able to participate in all of that. It was a great conference, and things were going really well. Well, we hope that if you're hearing the show today, you'll be able to give us a call. The phone number, of course, is 864-244-9904. That's 864-244-9904. You can also reach us by trying 864-201-6955 or 864-244-8177. And we hope you'll do that, because we are interested in hearing from you, especially this morning, as we want to find out where people are actually listening. Okay, well, we have a number of different stories here. Where should I start? So hard to decide where to start. Does Judge Alito reflect George W. Bush's libertarian streak? Does he really have a libertarian streak? Well, Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito is so far from being a libertarian that I thought even the D.C. libertarian establishment would sit this one out. It seems, however, that I've overestimated our friends in the nation's capital. Thus, we are presented with an article from the Cato Institute by George Mason University professor Ela Salmon praising Alito's libertarian streak. Let's look at what he says and why Alito doesn't have anything close to a libertarian streak. Alito and religious freedom. Professor Summons begins by repeating Benjamin Shapiro's line that Alito is a great on religious freedom. As my previous piece on Alito, I ask, who cares whether some cops get to wear a beard? Why, in any event, should the federal government dictate the terms of local police departments' employment agreements any more than they should dictate those of private employers? Libertarianism isn't about freedom for cops. It's about freedom for people who just want to have government leave them alone. And he also goes on and talks a little bit about some other things that Alito's there. This article is so long, I'm not going to be able to read the whole thing. Let's just jump to the conclusion. He says, in fairness, I probably would have reached the same conclusion as Alito in a particular case that he's been talking about, because the law requires an extremely high level of deference to a deportation decision. Indeed, in this instance, my problem is not with Judge Alito so much as it is with Mr. Salmon for giving a phony impression of what happened in the case and suggesting that there was something libertarian about it when, as far as I can tell, there was not in either outcome or reasoning. In conclusion, Judge Alito has an unusually lengthy history of judicial opinions and other writings from which we can form ideas about his view of the law. From all of this, Professor Salmon has taken a tiny handful of cases to make his case that Alito has a libertarian streak, and, as we have seen, even most of those cases provide no evidence for any such claim. I won't speculate as to why an ostensibly libertarian organization would want to get behind Judge Alito or anyone George W. Bush would consider worthy of the Supreme Court, let alone stretch so far to do so. They, of course, can waste their time and efforts however they like. I'm rather confident that Alito will be confirmed with or without their help. I only hope no one is taken in by their campaign and moved to spend their own resources supporting this unmistakably statist judge on the bogus premise that doing so will somehow advance liberty. Well, okay, there's another critique of Judge Alito. You know, he did have a couple of cases, or not cases, and as an employment application yesterday, it was said that Alito said something about his, you know, in favor of a pro-life position in 1985, 20 years ago. However, the cases which he's ruled on gave much calm to Democrats and other leftists on the issue of abortion. Apparently, they're not going to worry too much about it because they see that he changed after that. He was in the Reagan administration or under the Reagan administration at that time, and since then he's ruled several times in favor of abortion rights, the abortion rights side from the bench. So we never were. Since we read that and a couple other things about his views on the living constitution and so forth, we've decided that Judge Alito is not going to be the true conservative justice. It seems to us that he's not, at any rate, and it also does not seem to us that Judge Alito is going to help us bring in freedom, and I appreciate this last article for it underscores that as well. All right, well, we're going to take a look at the weather here. I know some of you are traveling along here in your cars, and we'd like to give you an up on what's going to be happening today in the weather.
Well, right now in Greenville-Spartanburg, it's 63 degrees, downtown 61 degrees, Anderson 63, and Clemson 62. Today it's going to be mostly cloudy with a 40% chance of showers and highs in the lower 70s.
Okay, great. And that's good stuff to know for today, isn't it? Well, how did Saddam Hussein become a grave threat? Michael Rosoff says on LouRockwell.com, President Bush officially took the U.S. into the war in Iraq on 3/19/03, citing Saddam Hussein as a grave threat, a man with weapons of mass destruction that endangers Americans. Within a few months, Americans began learning that this charge was false. Saddam posed no significant weapons of mass destruction, or at least according to seekers found none anywhere they searched. Therefore, the charge that he gave was a grave threat was also false. You know, Bob Schultz on Saturday talked about this whole issue of how President Bush basically deceived us into a war, and he did a good job in demonstrating this fact. He also showed how his petitions for redress of grievances have been ignored. Of course, the First Amendment guarantees we have the right of a petition to redress grievances, and it was just ignored entirely by George W. Bush, by the Congress, by the judiciary. And the judiciary actually said they agreed in the lower court, at any rate, with the state that, look, You have the right in the United States to make a petition for a redress of grievances, but we do not have an obligation to answer it or do anything about it. And George Shultz, it's analogous to saying, well, you have the right to vote, but we don't have the obligation to count them. And he's right. He said we transferred from a constitutional republic into a full-fledged democracy as soon as we allowed that to happen. And right now, as far as he's concerned, the transition is complete. We have the rule by the majority. Minorities have no protection under the First Amendment anymore, since it's completely ignored. And what a shame that is. My thoughts then in my speech were, you know, well, what's the solution? Well, Bob Shultz, and by the way, Bob Shultz and my talks are on the, they'll be playing on the Tyranny Response Network today, in case you're interested in listening in. They've been recorded and they're already there for your listening enjoyment. Well, Bob Shultz said that we should go on a hunger fast. Basically, we should sit on the steps of the Capitol, you know, and thousands of us just you know, go on a fast so that so many people around the world can see us and see that our democracy is now reigning here and that we no longer have a constitutional republic. Tell the world this. Now, I don't know what that's going to do. Fine. If you want to do that, great. But I think it's just avoiding the inevitable. I mean, the next step, the ultimate check we have on the state is what, folks? It's the Second Amendment, not the First Amendment. If they won't listen to your petitions for redress of grievances, you have to start planning for how we can secede or how you can actually stop them by using violence of arms. I mean, that's why you have the Second Amendment. And he didn't want to go there. I asked the question in my talk because it seemed to me the only logical conclusion. If they won't listen anymore, then you've arrived at a point where it's over. America's Constitution is dead, the Republic is dead, and you have to move to the next step. And that's a gruesome thought. That's not what we're looking for, unfortunately. But at some point, it probably had to happen simply because empires don't last forever. I mean, eventually, people who want freedom will have to resist the tyrants, and they will not listen right now. You're walking down the primrose path, and they're not being very pleasant company keepers. All right, let me skip down to this article just a little bit, and then we'll jump to a break. This article continues on, and is to say, we have yet to see the full consequences of this war in terms of shifting resources away from going after terrorists and fostering new terrorists and strengthening Iran and Iraq and encouraging Islamic fundamentalism and weakening the U.S. and in other ways yet unrevealed. If Saddam Hussein was not a grave threat, how did so many people come to view him as one? If we can answer these questions in depth, then perhaps we can learn something more about the fundamental failings of our system of state and government. Answers to historical questions have often no simple beginnings. We might begin, for example, on February 19, 1998, when a group sent an open letter to President Clinton calling for a determined program to change the regime in Baghdad. This letter was signed by 40 individuals, including Pearl, Adams, Bolton, Faith, Gaffney, Kagan, Crystal, Lieden, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Wormser, as well as former high government officials like Weinberger, Carlucci, and McFarlane. That's interesting. So they decided to write up a little note and say, let's get rid of this guy. And so maybe the neocons were behind this at the beginning. And he documents this throughout his article here. And he concludes an earnest and informed opinion for months about before and after 9/11/01 included a number of high-ranking Bush administration officials and did not regard Iraq as a mortal, serious, or imminent threat to the U.S. Officials knew of Saddam Hussein's interest in rebuilding his weapons. He says he can begin the story back in 1998 or in 1993, and he finds that there's almost a conspiracy going on to undermine Saddam Hussein and make him or demonize him and then take him out. Bush's statements were part of a flow of statements prior to an important vote. Enough warm-up acts. Let us raise the curtain and begin the story with Bush as a candidate in 1999-2000 as president-elect. It was all about finding a way to do it. It was the tone of it. The president saying, go find me a way to do this. And oil played a role, he said, in 2001. And the 9/11 disaster galvanized the pro-Iraq war contingency, including Bush. That afternoon, Rumsfeld asked aides whether the information was good enough to hit Saddam Hussein. Wesley Clark relates that he was pressured that day to blame 9/11 on state-sponsored terrorism and link it to Saddam Hussein. The only problem was that while Bush insiders took it for granted that war against Iraq was right and appropriate, many others did not. The solution was to launch or devise or manufacture rationales for a war against Iraq. A link between Al-Qaeda and 9/11 was one such rationale. Undeterred, Clark reports the administration in October continued the search for Al-Qaeda Iraq link and never quite gave up and never quite found one either, because it wasn't there. After the anthrax events in the U.S., both intelligence agents and scientists searched for a link to Iraq. None was found. The anthrax strain was American. A short 3 months after 9/11, the Iraq war hawks had won the day. No significant change has occurred on the ground in Iraq since the time a few months earlier when administration officials like Powell, Rumsfeld, Rice, and Cheney spoke of Iraq as weak and contained. In truth, then, Iraq was not a grave danger and was unable to accomplish those alarming activities. The following months brought even further departures from the truth, and he continues on to discuss some of those. Norman Podhoretz has argued that Bush believed that he was saying because the CIA director Tenet assured him that the weapons of mass destruction case was a slam dunk, should continue. The question of whether or not Bush believed what he was saying or lied may be important for impeachment hearings or for psychologists for its entertainment value, but is somewhat peripheral. False ideas and falsehoods became prevalent in a culminated war, whether or not certain people fully believed them or not. But there would be major problems funding a legal justification to use military force subject to law officers' advice. None currently exist, it starkly warned. And so there's a huge long-term cost. Colleagues know that Saddam and the Iraqi regime are bad. Neither the extent of the threat nor the reasons for tackling it are now were clear. Mr. Straw said it was doubtful that America would be considered a military action if September 11 attacks had not occurred. And we know, we have some belief that those attacks were staged even by the American government or something else other than what the news media has shown us. But at the same time, there was no credible evidence that the link to Iraq, to Osama bin Laden, and to Al-Qaeda. On 9/23/02, Rumsfeld resurrected the linkage of Iraq to Al-Qaeda, stating it is accurate and not debatable. That is the most clever set of statements with the obvious design of convincing the listener that Iraq is in grave danger as well. And this was, of course, false. Bush invoked the memory of 9/11 and the pledge to confront every threat from any source that could bring sudden terror and suffering into America. And Bush, of course, was telling a story. It was all false. Okay, well, this is where we've come, folks. He sums it up. Says, one day later, Bush continued with a laundry list of specific charges against the Iraq regime. Many were at best misleading and at worst were lies. Making war over the inability of a foreign country to account for some chemical purchased 15 years ago that may have been stolen, sold, or lost or deteriorated is not an exercise in rationality. It's even less rational when one is dealing with individuals from a foreign culture who may place quite a different emphasis on answering up quickly and correctly the demands of Westerners, and very true. At any rate, I think he's bringing up lots of key points, and again, they're being ignored everywhere. Everybody's talking about how horrible things were with you know, this war in Iraq. Now everybody's starting to see it, but now if there's a few neocons. There are the folks here in Greenville on the news radios and the networks elsewhere that are saying, look, This is terrible. We had all these problems in Iraq, and we did good over there, and George Bush did the right thing by taking out Saddam, and killing all these people was the right thing to do, and it's sad, but that's just the way it goes. And they said they're justifying the bad behavior of George Bush and the Republicans, and that is a shame. All right, we're way overdue for a break, so I guess we'll go ahead and jump to a break now, and you're listening to Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben, and we'll be back in just a minute.
If you have a question or comment for the show, please dial 864-244-9904, 864-244-8177, or 864-201-6955. Calls are received 7:30 a.m. to 9 o'clock a.m. weekday mornings. If you are listening at any other time, you are listening to a recording. You may also email your questions or comments to questions@policyofliberty.net. A patriot must always be ready to defend his country against his government. Edward Abbey.
The Patriot Network is a national federation of local clubs devoted to bringing relief to the oppressed American taxpayer. It is based right here in the South Carolina Upcountry and chaired by Dr. John Coben's associate, legendary freedom warrior Robert Clarkson. Visit our website at patriotnetwork.info for full contact information, meeting times, and locations around the South and beyond. That's Patriot Network, one word, .info. There you can also sample many action reports, current and past issues of our newsletter, and mainstream news features about IRS rot, corruption, and incompetence. Find out what our decades-old organization may be able to do to put a stop to your IRS problems. PatriotNetwork.info commends Dr. John Coben on the founding of the Tyranny Response Network and his unique Christian worldview show, heard weekday mornings right here on TRN. You're listening to TRN, the Tyranny Response Network, where we comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable.
And we welcome you back to Christian Worldview. In fact, we also have another article here on from the Mises Economics blog, and this is called Bush's Foul Play with the F-O-W-L, is the way you spell foul, by Jeffrey Tucker. He's one of our favorites, of course. He says, in his classic case of news of the weird, President Bush gave a press conference the other day to announce yet another central plan to deal with yet another disaster. This time an impending disaster, so he claimed it seemed, and some birds are catching a flu called avian or influenza, or more commonly the bird flu. It causes ruffled feathers and a drop in egg production. It can kill a chicken in 2 days flat. Scary. The chicken littles at the White House got wind of this and decided to hatch a plan for dealing with the eventuality that it will wipe out whole cities inhabited by people. That's people, not birds. You want $7.1 billion from you and me in emergency funding, no less, to protect us from the wrath of this disease, which he says could sweep the country and kill 1.9 million people and hospitalize another 9.9 million. Part of the money will go for pandemic preparedness, and part will go to individual states so they can cobble together their own plans for our health and well-being. As part of this plan, there was a website, pandemicflu.gov, which is also a helpful link if you haven't so far believed a word you have read. Here you can click around and find the mother of all all flu reports, the National Strategy of Pandemic Influenza. Be assured that the federal government will use all instruments of national power to address the pandemic threat. That includes FEMA, the Department of Homeland Security, and 100 other concrete places, palaces in D.C. In this report, you will find what you must do. Be prepared to follow health guidance that may include limitation of attendance at public gatherings and non-essential travel for several days a week. The government, meanwhile, will establish contingency systems to maintain delivery of essential goods and services during times of significant and sustained worker absenteeism. Yes, we are really supposed to believe the government will maintain delivery of essential goods and services. Your job is to sit in your house and wait. But let's just say that government has a credibility problem here. Also, the Bush administration has a role for the military to do for the flu what terrorism did in Iraq, determine the spectrum of public health, medical, and veterinary surge capacity activities that the U.S. military and other government entities may be able to support during a pandemic. Remarkable what the military can do, from spreading democracy to libertarian the press to curing the sick. That is, when we're not making people sick or killing them for their own good. Just to show this isn't a mere perfunctory line, Bush went out of his way to defend the role of the military in his press conference. One option is the use of the military that's able to plan and move, he said. So that's why I put it on the table. I think it's an important debate for Congress to have. Now, should this mass death come about, our future would be rife with many uncertainties. But one thing we can know for sure, any attempt by government to manage the crisis will add calamity to disaster. It will be 9/11 plus New Orleans, plus other amazing failures, all rolled into one. And the worst part of government failure will present itself rather than make a mess of its own responsibilities. The government acts to prevent people from doing what they should be doing to deal with the crisis. Stop in the name of the law isn't just a slogan from the cop shows. It's the sum total of everything the government does. The Bush administration, however, which is supposedly staffed by people learned in the wisdom of classical conservative thought and informed by revelation from America's traditional religious heritage, is just darn sure that government is the best and only means to handle such a crisis as this. A dazzling display of absurdity and chutzpah. That's what the Bush press conference, that was what the Bush press conference was on the flu. Even if the flu does come and taxpayers have coughed up, the government will surely have a ball imposing travel restrictions, shutting down schools and businesses, quarantining cities, and banning public gatherings. It's a bureaucrat's dream. Whether it will make us well again is another matter. And why should individuals on their own have no incentive to deal with disease? Why should the private sector have no reason to make cures available if they exist? Why are we to believe that the government would somehow do a better job at this level of crisis management than the private sector? None of these questions have been asked, much less answered. So I'm reading along the New York Times. It usually says this: the bird flu has infected about 120 people and killed 60. The virus has yet to pass easily among humans as is necessary to create a pandemic. Experts debate whether or not it ever will, and most believe the pandemic flu is inevitable. Most believe the pandemic flu is inevitable someday. Well, as Roderick Long often says, such contingencies, anything can happen. Men from Mars could land in capsules and paint and plant red weed all over the world. The question we need to ask is how likely it is, and who or what should address the problem should it arise. The World Health Organization provides a link to data about human infection. It says something about, although avian influenza A viruses usually do not infect humans, several instances of human infections have been reported since 1997. So we've gone from hundreds of infections to several. And when you look at specifics, most were not human-to-human infections, but people in closer contact with sick birds than most anyone ever is. And even among them, most patients recovered. For example, H9N2 infection was confirmed in a child in Hong Kong. The child was hospitalized and recovered. In another case in Canada, infections resulted in eye infections. Among those who did die, it was not a clear case of avian, although the site offers the following odd phrasing: the possibility of person-to-person transmission could not be ruled out. For this, we get a presidential news conference. As far as I can tell, the prospect of millions dying from bird flu is pretty remote. If it does happen, and anything can happen, then why must government be involved at all? Economists might invoke public goods rationale. Pandemic disease protection is a service that cannot be consumed by additional consumers at no additional cost, and the beneficiaries cannot be excluded from the good once it's produced. Thus, this service will not be produced in sufficient quantity in the private sector. The point is so far flung that it makes a case for a Randall Holcomb's theory of the theory of public goods. It is the best interest of those who run the government to promote public goods theory, and the best way to understand the theory is the justification for the legitimacy of the programs the government wants for itself. It is a tool the government uses for its own benefit. What about the private sector alternative? It will manage it as it can be expected. The price of vaccines will rise and draw more producers into the market. Businesses will establish their own rules about who can come and go. Private charities will deal with sickness. It isn't a perfect solution, but it's an improvement on dispatching the Marines or having the government provide essential goods and services. What's more, the problem of bird flu isn't even news. Since incidents of human infection are several years old, why does the Bush administration choose now to make such a big showing of its preparations for mass death by bird? Could it be that it's running out of other pretexts for expanding power? Terrorism is getting boring. Floods come only rarely. Communism is long gone. The China threat is no longer selling. The Mideast is dull. Global warming is just too silly, and people have gone back to ignoring most everything that comes out of Washington. Meanwhile, the regime is desperate to be liked again and forever relieve its salad days after 9/11. That still leaves the question of why so many public health officials seem so hopped up about the bird flu, even though the data doesn't come anywhere near supporting their frenzy. The answer is buried somewhere in those gargantuan budget numbers. Someone somewhere is going to get that $8 billion, and it's not going to be you or me. Mises on the phony crisis in his home, $10. Whoa. What's remarkable is how the little comment the bird flu plan provoked. We seem to have reached the stage in American public opinion where hysterical frenzies by government and totalitarian plans to take away all liberties are treated just as another day. We see the president telling us to fork over billions, and we turn the channel. Was it this way in the old Soviet Union or East Germany when the state newscast went on every night about the march of socialism? Has crisis management become the great white noise of American life? It is a serious matter when the government purports to plan to abolish all liberty and nationalize all economic life and put every business under the control of the military, especially the name of a bug that seems largely restricted to the bird population. Perhaps we should pay more attention. Perhaps such plans for the total state ought to even ruffle our feathers a bit. And it's a great blog. We appreciate Jeff Tucker's pointing this out about this mysterious, yet not so mysterious, avian flu or the bird flu. All right, this has been today's edition of Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. What we're planning to do with the rest of the hour is let you sit back and enjoy a couple things. First of all, we'll have the Bill of Rights. We'll maybe tell you the weather one more time before we go. And then we'll have the Bill of Rights for you. And we will have then the program which I gave down in Atlanta, the conference there called when I dealt with smog and allodialism. We hope you'll enjoy that. And we look forward to having you back here for another great edition of Christian Worldview tomorrow, right here on the Tyranny and Response Network. So signing off for today, this is Dr. John Coben. And until tomorrow, God bless you.
Thank you for joining us today on Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben. We hope you will be with us tomorrow morning at 7:30 right here at the Tyranny Response Network for Christian Worldview with Dr. John Coben.
First 10 Amendments of the American Constitution. Amendment 1.